Moto Casino, American Social Casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends, with thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, American Social Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
This is the story of the one. As a custodial supervisor at a high school, he knows that during cold and flu season, germs spread fast. It's why he partners with Grainger to stay fully stocked on the products and supplies he needs, from tissues to disinfectants to floor scrubbers. All so that he can help students, staff, and teachers stay healthy and focused. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Moto Casino, American Social Casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends, with thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, American Social Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Lowe's knows how to help make your home holiday ready for less. Get Select Style Selections vinyl flooring for just $1.99 per square foot and have it installed before the festivities begin. Our team can help you every step of the way. See a Lowe's Red Vest associate or visit lowes.com/holiday install to get started. Lowe's, we help, you save. Basic install only. Date restrictions apply. Subject to availability. Install by independent contractor. See associate for details. Contiguous U.S. only.
This is the Hidden Killers podcast. In this episode, we dive into the unsettling case of Jennifer Farber Dulos, who vanished on May 24, 2019. Amidst a divorce and custody battle, her estranged husband, Fotis Dulos, and his partner, Michelle Trokinis, became the center of a shocking conspiracy. Today, we bring you up to the moment coverage from the courtroom as Trokinis faces trial, accused of a role in this presumed murder.
Would counsel stipulate, please?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yes, Judge.
So, ladies and gentlemen, at this time, what the court will do is advise you on the law of the case. Because this will take approximately 50 minutes, the court has asked the clerk's office to make a copy of the instructions for each one of you. And we will ask Madam Clerk to hand out those copies now. You may choose to listen some and read some. You may choose to just read along. That's up to you. You have heard the evidence presented in the case. It is now this court's duty to instruct you on the law which applies in this case. It is solely this court's function to explain the law that applies in this case and how you are to apply it. It is your obligation to accept the law as the court states it. You may not choose to follow some instructions and ignore other instructions. They are equally important. You are the sole judges of the facts. It is your duty to find or determine the facts. You are to recollect and weigh the evidence and form your own conclusions concerning the facts. You may not go outside of the evidence presented in court to determine what the facts are. You may not resort to guesswork, conjecture, or suspicion. You may not be influenced by personal likes or dislikes, prejudices, or sympathy. You may not be influenced by this court's actions during the trial or the comments to counsel or objections by counsel. You may not be influenced by the court's questions to witnesses. You are not to consider this court's actions as an indication of its opinion as to how you should determine the facts. If during the instructions the court refers to any evidence, it is only for the purpose of clarifying a point of law or a point of illustration. The court does not intend to emphasize some evidence and downplay other evidence. If the court's recollection of the evidence does not match your recollection controls. The defendant justly relies upon you to consider carefully her claims and to consider carefully all of the evidence. The defendant also relies upon you to find her not guilty if the facts and the law require such a verdict. At your hands, the defendant rightly expects fair and just treatment. At the same time, the state of Connecticut looks to you to render a verdict of guilty if the facts and the law require such a verdict. The law prohibits the state's attorneys or defense counsel from giving personal opinions about the defendant's guilt or non-guilt. It is not their assessment of the credibility of witnesses that matters. Only yours matters. In this case, as in all criminal prosecutions, the defendant is presumed to be innocent unless and until proven guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. The presumption of innocence continues with this defendant unless you determine, based on all of the evidence considered in light of these instructions after deliberations, that the defendant is guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. The presumption of innocence applies individually to the crimes charged. The presumption may be overcome only if you are satisfied after deliberations that the state has proven the defendant's guilt to the crimes charged beyond a reasonable doubt. If you conclude that the presumption of innocence has been overcome beyond a reasonable doubt, then it is your duty to render a verdict of guilty on that count. The state has the burden of proving that the defendant is guilty of the crimes with which she is charged. The defendant does not have to prove innocence. This means that the state must prove beyond a reasonable doubt each and every element necessary to constitute the crime charged. Whether the state carries its burden does not depend on the number of its witnesses or on the amount of the testimony, but on the nature and quality of the testimony. One witness's testimony may be sufficient to convict if it establishes all of the elements of the crimes charged beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, you have heard the term reasonable doubt. The court will instruct you now on its meaning. We will first explain what is not a reasonable doubt. It is not a surmise, a guess, or a mere conjecture. It is not a doubt raised simply for the sake of raising a doubt. It is not hesitation springing from any feelings of sympathy for the defendant or for any other person affected by your decision. Reasonable doubt is a real doubt, an honest doubt, a doubt that has its foundation in the evidence or lack of evidence. It is a doubt that is honestly entertained and is reasonable in light of the evidence after a fair comparison and careful examination of the entire evidence. When thinking about the term reasonable doubt, concentrate on the word reasonable. Proof beyond a reasonable doubt does not mean proof beyond all doubt. The law does not require absolute certainty on the part of the jury before it returns a verdict of guilty. The law requires that after hearing all of the evidence, if there is something in the evidence or lack of evidence that leaves in your minds a reasonable doubt as to the guilt of the accused, then the accused must be given the benefit of that doubt and be acquitted. Proof beyond a reasonable doubt is proof that rules out every reasonable hypothesis except guilt, and is inconsistent with any other rational conclusion except guilt. The state has the burden of proving the defendant's guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, and that burden of proof rests with the state. It means that the state must prove beyond a reasonable doubt every element of each crime charged. The court will now discuss intent. Intent relates to the condition of the mind of the person who commits the act. It is his or her purpose in doing it. Specific intent is the intent to achieve a specific result. A person acts intentionally with respect to a result when his conscious objective is to cause such result. What the defendant intended is a question of fact for you to determine. All of the crimes charged in this case are specific intent crimes. As with all of the other elements, intent must be proved beyond a reasonable doubt. The court would indicate to the marshals that no one is to enter the courtroom when the court is giving instructions. No one's to leave.
Yes, Your Honor.
The court will next instruct you on proximate cause. The state must prove beyond a reasonable doubt that Fotis Doulos proximately caused the death of Jennifer Doulos. Proximate cause does not necessarily mean the last act, cause, or the act and point of time nearest the death. The concept of proximate cause incorporates the principle that an accused may be charged with a criminal offense even though her acts were not the immediate cause of the death. An act or omission to act is a proximate cause of the decedent's death when it substantially and materially contributes in a natural and continuous sequence, unbroken by an efficient intervening cause, to the death. It is a cause without which the death would not have occurred. It is a predominating cause, a substantial factor from which the death follows as a natural, direct, and immediate consequence. What a person's intention was is usually a matter of inference. No person is able to testify that he looked into another person's mind and saw therein a certain knowledge or a certain purpose or an intention to harm someone else. Because it is very hard to have direct evidence of the defendant's state of mind, intent is generally proved by circumstantial evidence. The only way a jury can ordinarily determine what a person's intention was at any given time is by determining what the person's conduct was and what the circumstances were surrounding that conduct, and from that, infer the defendant's intention. As jurors, it is your function to draw those inferences as long as the inference you draw meets the standard it has to meet as explained in connection with the instruction on circumstantial evidence. You are not required to infer a particular intent from the defendant's conduct or statements, but you may draw an inference if it is reasonable and logical. The burden of proving intent beyond a reasonable doubt is on the state. Now, the law does not require that the state in a criminal case prove a motive because it is not a necessary element of the crimes charged. It is not necessary for the state to prove what reason the defendant may have had for committing the crimes charged. Because crimes are generally committed for some motive, evidence of a motive may tend to prove the guilt of the defendant. In the same manner, if there appears no adequate motive, on the part of the defendant to commit the crime, that may tend to raise a reasonable doubt as to the guilt of the defendant. If the existence of a motive can be reasonably inferred, that may tend to prove the defendant's guilt. If no motive can be inferred, it may or may not raise a reasonable doubt as to the guilt of the defendant. If the absence of a motive does not raise a reasonable doubt that the defendant is guilty, then the fact that the state has not proved what the defendant's motive was does not prevent you from returning a verdict of guilty. We will now discuss direct and circumstantial evidence. The evidence from which you will decide what the facts are consists of one, sworn testimony of witnesses both on direct and cross-examination, regardless of who called the witness. Two, the exhibits which have been admitted into evidence. Three, any facts which the court judicially noticed. And four, any stipulations of the parties. In reaching your verdict, you should consider all the testimony and exhibits admitted into evidence. Certain things are not evidence, and you may not consider them in deciding what the facts are. These include arguments and statements by lawyers. The lawyers are not witnesses. What they have said in their closing arguments is intended to help you interpret the evidence, but their remarks to you are not evidence. If the facts as you remember them differ from the way the lawyers have stated them, your recollection prevails. Now, testimony that has been excluded or stricken. Some testimony may have been stricken, which means you may not consider it. Please remember that a lawyer's question by itself is not evidence, and you may not consider it as such. Now, the document called the information. You will have this document with you at the time you deliberate. The information is the formal manner of accusing a person of a crime. You must not consider the information as any evidence of the guilt of the defendant or draw any inference of guilt because she has been charged with a crime. As you will see, each count in the information contains the date and location of each offense. The state does not have to prove the exact time, date, or location of the offense beyond a reasonable doubt. However, the state must prove each element of the offense, including the identity of the defendant, beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, there are two kinds of evidence, direct and circumstantial evidence. Direct evidence is testimony by a witness about what that witness personally saw or heard or did. Circumstantial evidence is indirect evidence. That is evidence from which you could find another fact exists, even though that fact has not been proved directly. There is no legal distinction between direct and indirect evidence as far as the weight of each is concerned. The law permits you to give equal weight to both. It is up to you to decide how much weight to give any particular evidence. Circumstantial evidence of an event, for example, is the testimony of witnesses as to the existence of certain facts or the occurrence of other events from which you may logically conclude that the event in question did occur. For example, you look out of the window before you go to bed and you see that it is raining. If you testify that you saw the rain falling, that is direct evidence of the fact that it had rained. On another night, you go to bed and the sky is clear. If you wake up the next morning and the car's on the street and the trees are wet, there is direct evidence of water on the cars, on the street, and on the trees, but there is circumstantial evidence that it had rained. There is no reason to be prejudiced against circumstantial evidence simply because it is circumstantial evidence. You may make many decisions based on circumstantial evidence every day. Proof by circumstantial evidence may be as conclusive as would be the testimony of a witness speaking about her personal observations. Before you decide that a fact has been proved by circumstantial evidence, you must consider all of the evidence in light of reason, experience, and common sense. Now, concerning credibility, in deciding what the facts are, you must consider all of the evidence. In doing this, you must assess the testimony and determine which testimony to believe and which testimony not to believe. You may believe all, a part, or none of a witness's testimony. In making that decision, you may take into account a number of factors, including: one, was the witness able to see, hear, or personally know about those things about which the witness testified? Two, how well was the witness able to recall and describe those things? Three, did the witness have an interest in the outcome of the case, or any bias or prejudice concerning any party or any matter involved in the case? Four, what was the witness's manner while testifying? Five, how reasonable was the witness's testimony in light of all of the evidence in the case? Six, was the witness's testimony contradicted by what that witness had said or done at another time, or by the testimony of other witnesses, or by other evidence? In deciding whether or not to believe a witness concerning any matter about which that witness has testified, keep in mind that people sometimes forget things. You need to consider whether a contradiction or omission is an innocent lapse of memory or a deliberate falsehood. Your assessment of the contradiction or omission may depend on whether the contradiction or omission concerned a small detail or an important fact. The weight of the evidence does not depend on the number of witnesses. It is the quality of the evidence, not the quantity of the evidence, that you must consider. In this case, the defendant elected not to testify. As you recall, the defendant has a constitutional right not to testify. That is her decision. You shall draw no negative or adverse inference from the fact that the defendant chose not to testify. Now, you may find that one or more witnesses made statements outside of court which are inconsistent with their trial testimony. You should consider this evidence only as it relates to the credibility of the witness's testimony, not substantive evidence of a fact. In other words, consider evidence of inconsistency as you would any other evidence where there is inconsistent conduct, and then determine the weight to be given to the witness's in-court testimony. Police officers testified in this case, and you must determine the credibility of a police officer in the same way and by the same standards as you would evaluate the testimony of any other witness. The testimony of a police officer is entitled to no special or exclusive weight merely because it comes from a police officer. You should recall his or her demeanor on the stand and manner of testifying, and should weigh his or her testimony as carefully as you would weigh the testimony of any other witness. You should weigh testimony of police officers against all other testimony you heard in the case. You should neither believe nor disbelieve a police officer's testimony merely because he or she is a police officer. In this case, certain witnesses have taken the stand, given their qualifications, and testified as expert witnesses. A person is qualified to testify as an expert if he or she has special knowledge, skill, experience, training, or education sufficient to qualify him or her as an expert on the subject to which the testimony relates. An expert is permitted not only to testify to the facts that he or she personally observed, but also state an opinion about certain circumstances. This is allowed because an expert from experience, research, and study generally has a particular knowledge of the subject of the inquiry and is more capable than a layperson of drawing conclusions from facts and basing an opinion upon them. An expert witness may state an opinion in response to a hypothetical question, and some experts have done so in this case. A hypothetical question is one in which the witness is asked to assume that certain facts are true and to give an opinion based on those assumptions. The value of the opinion given by the expert in response to a hypothetical question depends upon the relevance, validity, and completeness of the facts he or she was asked to assume. The weight that you give to the opinion of an expert will depend on whether you find that the facts assumed were proved and whether the facts relied on in reaching the opinion were complete, or whether material facts were omitted or not considered. Like all other evidence, an expert's answer to a hypothetical question may be accepted or rejected in whole or in part according to your best judgment. Allowing someone to give expert testimony is in no way an endorsement by the court of the testimony or the credentials of the witness. Such testimony is presented to assist you in your deliberations. Marshall, if there's an emergency, you can let the individual out, but she cannot come back in. No such testimony is binding upon you, and you may disregard the testimony either in whole or in part. It is for you to consider the testimony with the other circumstances in the case, and using your best judgment, determine whether you will give any weight to it, and if so, what weight you will give to it. The testimony is entitled to such weight as you find the expert's qualifications in his or her field entitle it to receive, and it must be considered by you, but is not controlling upon your judgment. You are also to consider his or her general credibility in accordance with the instruction on credibility applicable to all witnesses. In this case, evidence in the form of stipulations between the parties was introduced to show certain facts. The stipulation is an agreement between the parties concerning some fact or facts which you as the jury are bound to accept as fact during your deliberation. This evidence included the designation and identification of physical evidence submitted to the state forensic laboratory. The stipulations are to be used only for the specific purposes for which they were entered into and not to be used for any other purpose. The stipulations do not include credibility or the weight you may give to the exhibits. You will have the stipulations with you during your deliberations. The state has the burden of proving beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant is the perpetrator of the alleged acts. In other words, the state has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt the identity of the defendant. Now, concerning witnesses testifying under immunity, you have heard the testimony of Pavel Gumieni. He testified under a grant of immunity. Although the state is permitted to present the testimony of someone who has been granted immunity, you must examine the testimony of such a witness who provides evidence against the defendant with greater care and caution than the testimony of an ordinary witness. While examining the testimony of a witness who has been granted immunity, you should keep in mind that he may have been looking for some favorable treatment when he agreed to speak with police and subsequently testify in exchange for immunity. Therefore, he may have such an interest in the outcome of this case that he may have an incentive to testify favorably for the state. You may consider whether his testimony was colored by his immunity, his agreement. Look at it with particular care. Look at his testimony with care and scrutinize it very carefully before you accept it. In considering the testimony of such a witness, you may consider whether there was any motive developed in the evidence for providing information inculpating the accused. The factors that you may consider, among others, when evaluating the credibility of such a witness include the extent to which the witness's testimony is confirmed by other evidence, the specificity of the testimony, the extent to which the testimony contained details known only by the perpetrator of the alleged offense, the extent to which the details of the testimony could be obtained from other sources, the circumstances under which the witness initially provided information supporting such testimony to law enforcement, and whether the witness has received the benefit, including immunity from prosecution, in exchange for testimony, and whether the witness has ever changed his testimony. Further, notwithstanding any language in the immunity agreement, it is your exclusive role to determine the credibility of that witness. In other words, you and you alone are to determine whether any evidence offered by Pavel Gumieni is to be believed wholly, partly, or not at all, irrespective of any language in the immunity agreement that may indicate otherwise. And after the name Pavel Gumieni in this draft, please just eliminate the word it. The determination as to whether the state has proven the elements of the crimes charged beyond a reasonable doubt rests solely with you after a careful examination of all of the evidence presented. However, you are not required to disbelieve a witness because he has been granted immunity. Some people in this position are entirely truthful when testifying. Again, it is your duty to decide whether Pavel Gumieni is to be believed wholly, partly, or not at all. The defendant is charged in count one with conspiracy to commit murder. Count one of the information reads, at various times and in various locations, including but not limited to the town of New Canaan on or about the 24th day of May 2019, in the area of 69 Wells Lane, Michelle Traconis, with intent that conduct constituting the crime of murder be performed, did agree with Fotis Doulos and other persons to engage in and cause the performance of that conduct, and one of them did commit an overt act in pursuance of the conspiracy, to wit, Fotis Doulos did assault Jennifer Farber Doulos in her home on the 24th day of May 2019 with intent to restrain and kill her in violation of section 53A-48A and 53A-54A subsection A of the Connecticut General Statutes. Here, the state alleges that the defendant committed the crime of conspiracy to commit murder and that a co-conspirator, Fotis Doulos, committed an overt act in furtherance of that conspiracy by murdering Jennifer Doulos. Before instructing you on the definition of conspiracy, the court will read to you the elements of the crime of murder. The statute defining murder reads in pertinent part as follows. A person is guilty of murder when, with intent to cause the death of another person, he causes the death of such person or of a third person. For you to find the defendant guilty of conspiracy to commit murder, the state must prove that Fotis Doulos committed murder by proving the following two elements beyond a reasonable doubt. The first element is that Fotis Doulos specifically intended to cause the death of Jennifer Doulos. There is no particular length of time for Fotis Doulos to have formed the specific intent to kill. A person acts intentionally with respect to a result when his conscious objective is to cause such result. The intent to cause death may be inferred from circumstantial evidence. The type and number of wounds inflicted, as well as the instrument used, may be considered as evidence of the perpetrator's intent. And from such evidence, an inference may be drawn that there was intent to cause a death. Any inference that may be drawn from the nature of the instrumentality used and the manner of its use is an inference of fact to be drawn by you upon consideration of these and other circumstances in the case in accordance with the previous instructions. Declarations and conduct of Fotis Doulos before or after the infliction of wounds may be considered if you find they tend to show his intent. The inference is not a necessary one. That is, you are not required to infer intent from Fotis Doulos' alleged conduct, but it is an inference you may draw if you find it is reasonable and logical and in accordance with the instructions on circumstantial evidence. The second element is that Fotis Doulos, acting with the intent to cause the death of Jennifer Doulos, caused the death of Jennifer Doulos. This means that Fotis Doulos' conduct was the proximate cause of the decedent's death. You must find it proven beyond a reasonable doubt that Jennifer Doulos died as a result of the actions of Fotis Doulos. The state does not have to produce evidence of Jennifer Doulos' body for you to find that she is deceased. The state is only required to prove that Jennifer Doulos is dead and her death was by criminal means. Proof of the exact cause of death is not required, nor does the state have to connect the weapon directly to Fotis Doulos and the crime. In determining whether or not the state has proven that Fotis Doulos caused the death of Jennifer Doulos beyond a reasonable doubt, you may consider both direct and circumstantial evidence. And please see the previous instructions on direct and circumstantial evidence. Again, the defendant is charged in count one with conspiracy to commit murder. The court has already defined the crime and all of the elements of murder. The statute defining conspiracy reads in pertinent part as follows. A person is guilty of conspiracy when, with the intent that conduct constituting a crime be performed, she agrees with one or more persons to engage in or cause the performance of such conduct, and any one of them commits an overt act in pursuance of such conspiracy. To constitute the crime of conspiracy, the state must prove the following elements beyond a reasonable doubt. One, there was an agreement between the defendant and one or more persons to engage in conduct constituting the crime of murder, which conspiracy the defendant specifically intended to join. Two, there was an overt act in furtherance of the subject of the agreement by any one of those persons. Three, the defendant specifically intended that one of the co-conspirators, namely Fotis Doulos, intended to commit the crime of murder. The size of the defendant's role does not determine whether she may be convicted of conspiracy. Rather, what is important is whether the defendant willfully participated in the activities of the conspiracy with knowledge of its illegal ends. Participation in a single act in furtherance of the conspiracy is enough to sustain a finding of knowing participation. The first element is that there was an agreement between two or more persons. It was not necessary for the state to prove that there was a formal or express agreement between them. It is sufficient to show that the parties intentionally engaged in a mutual plan to do a criminal act. Circumstantial evidence is sufficient to prove that there was an agreement because conspiracies, by their very nature, are formed in secret and only rarely can be proven by other than circumstantial evidence. It is not necessary to establish that the defendant and the defendant's alleged co-conspirators signed papers, shook hands, or uttered the words, "We have an agreement." But rather, a conspiracy can be inferred from the conduct of the accused. The mere knowledge acquiescence or approval of the object of the agreement without cooperation or agreement to cooperate is not sufficient to make one a party to a conspiracy to commit the criminal act. Mere presence at the scene of the crime, even when coupled with knowledge of the crime, is insufficient to establish guilt of the conspiracy to commit the crime. In order to convict a person of conspiracy, the state need not show that such person had direct communication with all other conspirators. It is not necessary that each conspirator be acquainted with all others or even know their names. It is sufficient if she has come to an understanding with at least one of the others and has come to such understanding with that person to further a criminal purpose. Additionally, it is not essential that she know the complete plan of the conspiracy in all of its details. It is enough if she knows that a conspiracy exists, or that she is creating one, that she is joining with it at least one person in an agreement to commit a crime. Therefore, in order to convict the defendant on the charge contained in the information, the first element is that the state must prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant specifically intended to enter into an agreement with at least one other person to engage in conduct constituting murder. The second element is that at least one of the alleged co-conspirators did an overt act to further the purpose of the conspiracy. It does not matter which one of the alleged co-conspirators did the overt act. It need not be the defendant, and it need not be a criminal act. An overt act is any step, action, or conduct that is taken to achieve or further the objective of the conspiracy. An overt act, therefore, is one that is committed or caused to be committed by any member of the conspiracy in an effort to accomplish some objective or purpose of the conspiracy. The overt act cannot, however, be held against the other alleged co-conspirators if it was not intended to further the general purposes of the conspiracy, but was secretly intended to further the actor's own personal purpose. The overt act must be a subsequent independent act that follows the formation of the conspiracy. The third element is that the defendant had the intent that a murder be committed. This means that the defendant must specifically intend that every element of the plan be accomplished. As to this count, the defendant may not be found guilty unless the state has proved beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant specifically intended that the murder be accomplished when she entered into the agreement. In summary, the state must prove beyond a reasonable doubt that, one, the defendant had an agreement with one or more persons to commit murder. Two, at least one of the co-conspirators did an overt act in furtherance of the conspiracy. And three, the defendant specifically intended to enter into the agreement and intended the conduct constituting the crime of murder be performed. If you unanimously find that the state has proved beyond a reasonable doubt each of the elements of the crime of conspiracy to commit murder, then you shall find the defendant guilty. On the other hand, if you unanimously find that the state has failed to prove beyond a reasonable doubt any one of the elements, you shall find the defendant not guilty. Court will now explain accessorial liability. A person is criminally liable for a crime if she directly commits it or if she is an accessory in the criminal act of another. The statute defining accessorial liability reads in pertinent part as follows. A person acting with the mental state required for the commission of an offense, who solicits, requests, commands, importunes, or intentionally aids another person to engage in conduct which constitutes an offense shall be criminally liable for such conduct and may be prosecuted and punished as if she were the principal offender. This statute does not connect those five acts specified with the word and, but separates them by the word or. A person is an accessory if she solicits or requests or commands or importunes or intentionally aids another person to engage in conduct that constitutes an offense. Solicit means to attempt or to entice someone to do wrong. Importune means to demand or urge. Aid means to assist, help, or support. A person acts intentionally with respect to a result when her conscious objective is to cause such result. Intentionally aid, therefore, means to act in any manner, the conscious objective of which is to assist, help, or support. And for this, please see the instruction on specific intent. If the state proves beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant did any of these things specified in the statute, she is guilty of the substantive crime, in this case, tampering with physical evidence, as though she had directly committed it or participated in its commission. To establish the guilt of the defendant as an accessory for assisting in the criminal act of another, the state must prove criminality of intent and community of unlawful purpose. That is, for the defendant to be found guilty as an accessory, it must be established that she acted with the mental state necessary to commit the crime of tampering with physical evidence. And in furtherance of that crime, she solicited, requested, commanded, importuned, or intentionally aided the principal to commit tampering with physical evidence. Evidence of mere presence as an inactive companion or passive acquiescence for the doing of innocent acts which, in fact, aid in the commission of a crime is insufficient to find the defendant guilty as an accessory under the statute. Nevertheless, it is not necessary to prove that the defendant was actually present or actively participated in the actual commission of the crime, in this case, tampering with physical evidence. The rule is that a person who solicits, requests, commands, importunes, or intentionally aids in the commission of a crime is guilty of that very crime. Thus, for you to find the defendant guilty of this charge, you must unanimously find that the state has proved beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant had the intent to commit the crime charged and did solicit, request, command, importune, or intentionally aid another in the commission of the crime of tampering with physical evidence. The court will now discuss the counts 2 and 4, conspiracy to commit tampering with physical evidence. The defendant is charged in counts 2 and 4 with conspiracy to commit tampering with physical evidence. Now, please refer to this court's instructions on the inchoate offense of conspiracy. Count 2 of the information reads, and the aforesaid state's attorney further accuses the defendant, Michelle Traconis, of conspiracy to commit tampering with physical evidence and charges that on or about the 24th day of May 2019 in the city of Hartford, Connecticut, in the area of Albany Avenue, the defendant, Michelle Traconis, with the intent that conduct constituting the crime of tampering with physical evidence be performed, did agree with Fotis Doulos to engage in and cause the performance of that conduct, and one of them did commit an overt act in pursuance of the conspiracy, to wit, the defendant traveled with Fotis Doulos to the Hartford area for the purpose of disposal of physical evidence relating to the murder of Jennifer Farber Doulos in the city of Hartford on the 24th day of May 2019 in violation of Section 53A-48 and 53A-155, Subsection A, Subsection 1 of the Connecticut General Statutes. Count 4 of the information reads, and the aforesaid state's attorney further accuses the defendant, Michelle Traconis, of conspiracy to commit tampering with physical evidence, and charges that on or about the 29th day of May 2019, in the town of Avon, Connecticut, in the area of 265 West Main Street, the defendant, Michelle Traconis, with the intent that conduct constituting the crime of tampering with physical evidence be performed, did agree with Fotis Doulos to engage in and cause the performance of that conduct, and one of them did commit an overt act in pursuance of the conspiracy, to wit, Fotis Doulos did transport a 2001 Toyota Tacoma used in the commission of the murder of Jennifer Farber Doulos to Russell Speeder's Car Wash in Avon on the 29th day of May 2019 for the purpose of having evidence related to that murder concealed and destroyed in violation of sections 53A-48A and 53A-155A1 of the Connecticut General Statute. First, the court must define the offense of tampering with physical evidence. A person is guilty of tampering with or fabricating physical evidence if believing that a criminal investigation conducted by a law enforcement agency or an official proceeding is pending or about to be instituted, she alters, destroys, conceals, or removes any item or thing with the purpose to impair its availability in such criminal investigation or official proceeding. The first element is that the defendant believed that a criminal investigation conducted by a law enforcement agency or an official proceeding was pending or about to be instituted. It does not matter whether the investigation or proceeding was actually pending or not, as long as the defendant believed that it was. An official proceeding is any proceeding held or that may be held before any legislative, judicial, administrative, or other agency or official authorized to take evidence under oath, including any referee, hearing examiner, commissioner, or notary, or other person taking evidence in connection with any proceeding. The second element is that the defendant tampered with physical evidence. Physical evidence means any article, object, or other item of physical substance that is or about to be produced or used as evidence in an official proceeding. The third element is that the defendant concealed, that really should read concealed, an item with the purpose of impairing its availability in such proceeding. A person acts with intent when her conscious objective is to cause such result. In summary, the state must prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant, one, believed that a criminal investigation conducted by a law enforcement agency, or an official proceeding was pending or about to be instituted, two, tampered with physical evidence, and three, specifically intended to conceal an item with the purpose of impairing its verity or availability. A person acts with intent when their conscious objective is to cause such result. If you unanimously find that the state has proved beyond a reasonable doubt each of the elements of the crime of tampering with physical evidence, you shall find the defendant guilty. On the other hand, if you unanimously find that the state has failed to prove beyond a reasonable doubt any one of the elements, you shall find the defendant not guilty. Now the court will discuss tampering with physical evidence as an accessory. The defendant is charged in counts 3 and 5 with tampering with physical evidence as an accessory. In considering the offense of tampering with physical evidence as an accessory, please refer to the court's instruction on accessorial liability. Count three of the information reads, and the aforesaid state's attorney further accuses the defendant, Michelle Tokonis, of tampering with physical evidence and charges that on or about the 24th day of May, 2019, within the city of Hartford, Connecticut, in the area of Albany Avenue, the defendant, Michelle Tokonis, believing that a criminal investigation conducted by a law enforcement agency was pending and about to be instituted, did alter, destroy, conceal, or remove a thing with the purpose to impair its availability in that criminal investigation and official proceeding, in violation of Section 53A-155A1 and 53A-8A of the Connecticut General Statutes. Count five of the information reads, and the aforesaid state's attorney further accuses the defendant, Michelle Tokonis, of tampering with physical evidence on or about the 29th day of May, 2019, within the town of Avon, Connecticut, in the area of 265 West Main Street. The defendant, Michelle Tokonis, believing that a criminal investigation conducted by a law enforcement agency was pending and about to be instituted, did alter, destroy, conceal, and remove a thing with the purpose to impair its availability in that criminal investigation and official proceeding, in violation of Section 53A-155A1 and 53A-8A of the Connecticut General Statutes. That sentence, ladies and gentlemen, should read in the disjunctive, to be instituted, it alter, destroy, conceal, or remove a thing, rather than and. As previously stated, the elements of tampering with physical evidence are as follows. Such person, one, believed that a criminal investigation conducted by a law enforcement agency was pending or about to be instituted, two, tampered with physical evidence, and three, specifically intended to impair the verity or availability of the evidence. Please refer back to the instructions on the elements of tampering with physical evidence. The rule is that a person who solicits, requests, importunes, or intentionally aids in the commission of a crime is guilty of that very crime. Thus, for you to find the defendant guilty of these counts as an accessory, you must unanimously find that the state has proved beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant had the intent to commit the crime charged and did solicit, request, command, importune, or intentionally aid another in the commission of the crime of tampering with physical evidence. If you unanimously find that the state has proved beyond a reasonable doubt each of the elements of the crime of tampering with physical evidence, then you shall find the defendant guilty. On the other hand, if you unanimously find that the state has failed to prove beyond a reasonable doubt any one of the elements, then you shall find the defendant not guilty. The defendant is charged in count six with hindering prosecution in the second degree. The statute defining this offense reads in pertinent part as follows. A person is guilty of hindering prosecution in the second degree when such person renders criminal assistance to another person who has committed a Class A felony. Murder is a Class A felony. For you to find the defendant guilty of this charge, the state must prove the following elements beyond a reasonable doubt. The first element is that the defendant rendered criminal assistance. A person renders criminal assistance when, with intent to prevent, hinder, or delay the discovery or apprehension of, or the lodging of a criminal charge against, a person whom she knows or believes has committed a felony, or is being sought by law enforcement officials for the commission of a felony, or with intent to assist a person in profiting or benefiting from the commission of a felony, provide such person with transportation or other means of avoiding discovery or apprehension, suppresses by an act of concealment, alteration, or destruction any physical evidence that might aid in the discovery or apprehension of such person or in the lodging of a criminal charge against such person. The second element is that she rendered criminal assistance to a person who committed a Class A felony. According to the law in Connecticut, murder is a Class A felony. The defendant need not know the classification of the felony. Please bear in mind, however, that although the person to whom the defendant rendered assistance must have actually committed murder, he need not have been arrested, prosecuted, or convicted of the offense. In summary, the state must prove beyond a reasonable doubt that one, the defendant rendered criminal assistance to Fotis Doulos, and two, Fotis Doulos committed murder. If you unanimously find that the state has proved beyond a reasonable doubt each of the elements of the crime of hindering prosecution in the second degree, then you shall find the defendant guilty. On the other hand, if you unanimously find that the state has failed to prove beyond a reasonable doubt any one of the elements, you shall find the defendant not guilty. Now, these are final instructions concerning note-taking and deliberations. If you took notes during the evidence, you may use them during your deliberations, and you may discuss your notes with your fellow jurors. Remember that notes are merely aids to your memory and should not be given precedence over your independent recollection of the evidence. If there is a conflict between your recollection and your notes, or the notes of any other juror, it is your recollection of the evidence that must prevail. No juror's notes constitute evidence. Please recall the earlier instruction on what constitutes evidence. Your verdict must be based exclusively on evidence presented at trial and the principles of law given to you in these final instructions. A juror who has not taken notes should rely on his or her recollection and not be influenced by the fact that other jurors have taken notes. Notes are only a tool and are not always accurate. Do not assume that a voluminous note taker is taking notes that are more accurate than your memory. You may discuss your notes with your fellow jurors during deliberations. The decision to discuss your notes is yours alone. After the trial has concluded, the court staff will collect the notes and destroy them. You may have testimony played back or video played back if you deem it essential during your deliberations. You will have all exhibits with you during your deliberations. In deciding whether the defendant is guilty or not guilty, you should not consider the possible punishment or consequences in the event of a conviction. This is a matter exclusively within the court's function under the limitations and restrictions imposed by statute. You are to find the defendant guilty or not guilty uninfluenced by the possible punishment or consequence that may follow. You should not be influenced by any sympathy for the defendant, the defendant's family, the complainant's family, or for any other person who in any way may be affected by your decision. Now, in conclusion, this court impresses upon you that you are duty-bound as jurors to determine the facts and apply the law as this court has explained it, and to render a verdict of not guilty or guilty as to each count. When you reach a verdict, it must be unanimous. It is the duty of each juror to discuss and consider the opinions of the other jurors. Despite that, it is your individual duty to make up your mind and to decide the case upon the basis of your own individual judgment and conscience. Soon you will retire to the jury room. Do not begin deliberations until you have selected one of your members as the foreperson of the jury, and you have received the information and the exhibits. You may only deliberate when all of you are present in the jury room. Please inform the marshal when you have reached the verdict, but do not tell the marshal your verdict. You will be asked to return to the courtroom where your foreperson will announce the verdict orally in response to questions from the courtroom clerk. The rest of the panel will be asked whether they concur with the verdict. If you have any questions, please send them out by way of a note signed by the foreperson and marked with the time of day, and please be specific. We would ask all of the regular jurors at this time to retire to the deliberation room and ask the alternates to remain.
Judge.
Your Honor, may we just approach it sidebar briefly?
Yes. So the court believes that for this case, over, the court believes 200 jurors were voir dired. And the responses that you gave to the attorneys and considered by the attorneys and also heard by this court showed that it was clear that you would be excellent jurors for this case. This case is different from a lot of cases. This case is different in complexity. This case is different in length. This case is different in media attention. The court will have to release you today from the jury. However, if any one of the jurors is not able to continue, you will have to be pressed back into service to continue the deliberations, which will start anew if you are required to come back. So it is with the gratitude of the state of Connecticut and the parties that we have had you as jurors in this case. There will be no lack of interest by the media in what you think, and hopefully you'll be able to get out of the door today before someone approaches you. What the court would instruct you to do is please, because you will be asked to return if jurors are no longer able to continue, avoid media coverage, avoid talking to the media, avoid talking to people about your service as a juror in this case. So we would thank you, and hopefully this experience has not been such that you cannot recover. So thank you, and please follow the marshal. And you may leave your notebooks and those instructions. And the court will hear counsel on exceptions to the charge.
Yes, Your Honor. Good afternoon. Judge, just on the bottom of, actually beginning the second half of page 52, and this relates specifically to counts 2 and 4, conspiracy to commit tampering with physical evidence. You did earlier in the charge direct the jury back to the incohit or the conspiracy instructions. However, the summary simply includes the elements for tampering with evidence. And my concern is that obviously the allegation here is a conspiracy, so we would just simply need to show that there was an agreement to commit tampering with evidence and that there was an overact in furtherance of the agreement, not that the defendant actually tampered with physical evidence for this particular count. And I would note also, Judge, that on page 56, with accessorial liability, you did bring the accessorial charge back when finalizing the summary. So I would ask that the court consider instructing the jury on the elements of conspiracy to commit tampering with evidence, namely that there was an agreement to tamper with evidence and an overt act by a co-conspirator.
So what the court will do, the court did have the opportunity, it was a short opportunity to have counsel review the final charge. So what the court would ask counsel to do, specifically the state, indicate on the final draft the language you want included. The court may have to just re-instruct the jury on that count.
Yes, Judge. I'll do that now.
And Attorney Schoenhardt.
Thank you. I would first just incorporate all of the arguments that I made and suggestions I made during our charging conference. And I'd also just note for the record that to the extent the court did not include my proposals, that I would request that the court, having done so, just to preserve the record. There are a few minor items that I only noted during the discussion. Yesterday, I know that the court did add, at the state's request, a proximate cause instruction. In reviewing it, however, I realized that in this particular case, there is no, this is the kind of instruction that if a person, I don't know, is shot, they go into the hospital, then they get sick, and then they die, the issue is the proximate cause. I don't know if that in this case it was appropriate, so I would have just objected to that instruction being given. I would note that on the bottom of page 12, when the court gave its motive instruction, which the state had proposed, it's both in the negative in the sense that if there's a motive, it says that it may tend to prove the defendant's guilt, but the next sentence says if there's no motive, it can be inferred not that it may raise a reasonable doubt, but may or may not. So I just note that was unbalanced in the sense that a motive may or may not tend to prove a guilt, and no motive may or may not raise a reasonable doubt, but the way it's written, it's only slanted towards the state's version of events, so I object to that. I said yesterday about the issue about the type and number of wounds inflicted should not have been included. We talked about that, but I think we ended up concentrating on whether it was a weapon, but I believe that this language about the type and number of wounds, we don't have any evidence of that in this case, so I've just renew my objection to that. I already said what I said on page 35. There's the reference to a weapon, and there I would just raise what I said before. On page 38, for the definition of conspiracy, it's not that just she activities that she have knowledge of its illegal ends. She has to have the specific intent to cause death. In other words, not just to have knowledge of its ends. It would have to be specific knowledge of the crime of murder itself. And finally, I believe on page 59, the court did leave in one of the elements, alternative ways to commit the crime of hindering is suppression by an act of concealment, alteration, or destruction. That's not in the criminal information, only the issue, the first one, which is the allegation that she provided a person with transportation or other means of avoiding discovery. Suppressing, concealing, altering, or destroying evidence is not in the information. That's certainly not it's not the same thing. It's different acts. So I would ask that the court remove that and instruct the jury to disregard that. Thank you.
Very good. Does the state wish to be heard on the last objection or exception by Attorney Schoenhorn concerning page 59?
Yes, I can jump in, Your Honor, because Attorney McGinnis is writing with respect to the conspiracy count. With respect to what counsel's indicating about, I'm sorry, if you can just direct me to the page.
Page 59, the second bullet point.
Oh, I think it's very clear in the state's charging, Your Honor, we charge transportation or other means of avoiding discovery or apprehension. Your Honor, I think we did discuss this yesterday, and Your Honor drew attention to the fact that there's that or other means. That or other means may act, the jury can take into account all or nothing that Your Honor cites in the jury instructions, so the state would ask that it remain as said.
And just briefly, I believe the charge has to do with avoiding discovery and apprehension of the person, not evidence, and that's why they're not the same.
Thank you. Attorney McGinnis is writing a lot, so the court is not certain they can read it. We can take a recess at this point and allow Attorney McGinnis to...
I can type it at the recess.
That would be better, and then the court will read... designate the page and ask the jury to consider this instruction rather than the one that was read.
Too many arrows.
So what we will do is just take a recess. How long do you think you will need it?
10 minutes.
Well, let's come back at 3:50. We'll stand in recess. Thank you.
All rise. This honorable speech.
Counsel stipulate, please.
Yes, Judge. Yes.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, the court read to you the instructions on the law. Now, you have a copy of it. Now, what the court would indicate is that if you see any sentence that doesn't make sense, you can just inquire of the court what word is missing, or is this misspelled, or are you missing an article? The or a, and it will just come to the court's attention that you're trying to figure out whether this is just a typographical error or whether that's what the court intended. Now, if you still have a copy of your instructions, the court is just going to direct you to the bottom of page 52. And at the bottom of page 52, there is a paragraph that begins, "If you unanimously," and it concludes on page 53. So what the court will ask you to do is just cross out that entire paragraph, and the court is going to read the substitute paragraph, and you will also get a copy of that substitute paragraph, so you do not have to take notes on the substitute paragraph. So instead of that last paragraph on the draft that the court gave you, this is how the last paragraph will read at the bottom of page 52. Counts 2 and 4, conspiracy to commit tampering with physical evidence. Now, as the court mentioned, the defendant is charged in counts 2 and 4 with conspiracy to commit tampering with physical evidence. Not the substantive offense of tampering with physical evidence. The court refers you back to previous instructions on the definitions of agreement and an overt act in furtherance of the conspiracy. In summary, therefore, the state must prove beyond a reasonable doubt, 1, that the defendant had an agreement with Fotis Doulos to commit tampering with evidence, 2, the defendant or Fotis Doulos did an overt act in furtherance of the conspiracy, and 3, the defendant specifically intended to enter into the agreement and intended the conduct constituting the crime of tampering with evidence. If you unanimously find that the state has proved beyond a reasonable doubt each of the elements of the crime of conspiracy to commit tampering with evidence, then you shall find the defendant guilty. On the other hand, if you unanimously find that the state has failed to prove beyond a reasonable doubt, well, this says any of the elements, any one of the elements, you shall then find the defendant not guilty. So that last line should read, on the other hand, if you unanimously find that the state has failed to prove beyond a reasonable doubt any one of the elements, you shall then find the defendant not guilty. This will be given to you. You can mark it up as you wish. Soon, the exhibits, all of the exhibits in the case are going to come to you. What also will come to you is a laptop. If you have any trouble with the laptop, well, we can troubleshoot for you. So if you could just retire to the deliberation room, all of the exhibits will be brought in. And at that time, when you are all in the deliberation room together, you can begin deliberating. You can retire to the deliberation room. And counsel have checked all of the exhibits? And
yes, we have.
And are they all there?
They are, and we've separated out the ID ones, I believe. And I also looked at the laptop, so I have no problems with that either.
Thank you. So, Madam Clerk, we'll get all of those exhibits into the jury room, and we'll stand in a recess.
All rise. This Honorable Superior Court now stands in recess. May I come to the court
in recess? So, ladies and gentlemen, we conclude for today. You should have all of the exhibits in the deliberation room. The court understands you also want an easel that will be. Well, we'll try to fix that sometime before you come in tomorrow. So when you come in tomorrow, we start at 10 o'clock. The court wants to make sure that everyone is here. After you come into the courtroom and the lawyers stipulate that all of you are present, then you can just begin your deliberation. So again, do not be surprised if the media tries to talk to you now. Your names and your addresses have not been made available to the media, but their efforts to try to find out who you are will not go unabated. So please, don't talk to the media, please. Don't discuss the case with anyone. Please follow no media reports about the case, and we hope to see you tomorrow. Have a good evening. Okay, we'll stand adjourned until tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock.
All right.
There's more to come at the Michelle Troconis trial in the Jennifer Farber Doulos case. The mystery deepens and justice seeks its course. Press subscribe now and stay tuned for more episodes unraveling the truths behind the most perplexing criminal cases from true crime today.
Moro Casino. American Social Casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino. American Social Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
This is the story of the one. As a custodial supervisor at a high school, he knows that during cold and flu season, germs spread fast. It's why, like you, he partners with Grainger to stay fully stocked on the products and supplies he needs, from tissues to disinfectants to floor scrubbers. All so that he can help students, staff, and teachers stay healthy and focused. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Moro Casino. America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Hey, wake up. New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, ugh, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's.
Moro Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Hey, wake up. New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, ugh, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's.
Moro Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Feel off? Tired? Moody? You might be missing minerals, because 99% of us are. Concentrace Daily Mineral Powder helps support energy, mood, and immunity from the inside out. Go to TraceMinerals.com and feel the difference minerals make.
Moro Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
You're doing all the right things, like eating clean and staying active, but nearly all of us are still missing a key piece, minerals. Concentrace Daily Mineral Powder helps restore what your body's not getting, supporting mood, energy, immunity, and nervous system balance. It's made from ionic trace minerals your body actually absorbs and comes in three delicious flavors, blue raspberry, blue Hawaiian, and blue acai. Because your body can't make minerals and modern food and water don't supply enough, start with minerals. Start with Concentrace. Find it now at TraceMinerals.com.
Moro Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moro Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.